But let me circle back to the other part of this. Hong Kong and this theory by Chinese officials that this is a United States plot, a CIA plot. Isn't there a huge piece of evidence against that just in the last few days? Because Hong Kong held local elections, and while they are for advisory positions, local council positions, they were overwhelmingly won by pro-democracy forces, by people who were against the power of the central government. How are Chinese officials explaining that, and how are they responding to it?
Well, it's very telling that the kind of state propaganda machine, which we've seen, you know, for months now, this drumbeat of propaganda about the violent protesters, how they're bent on revolution, how they're in cahoots with the Americans. After this election result, which was not just a kind of landslide, it was a wipeout. You know, you saw 17 out of 18 councils change hands against the pro-Beijing parties. They went silent. So the real crisis for the Communist Party in Beijing is that the people of Hong Kong, they have this hybrid identity. It is legally part of China, but it is one of the great Western world cities. It's a vibrant financial city. I'm sure many of your listeners have been there. And if asked to choose between that Western, liberal, uncensored, free speech style of life and being part of a kind of rising China and a much more like another city in China, the people of Hong Kong are making it absolutely clear that even as China gets richer and stronger, they want to be part of the Western world, not part of that mainland China. And that's a gigantic snub to an otherwise very self-confident Chinese government on the mainland.
Now, I do know that the pro-Beijing chief executive of Hong Kong gave a kind of humble statement saying that she would respect the results of the elections. But what does that actually mean? Is China actually likely to give ground here?
The really tragic truth is that it could turn out to be a Pyrrhic victory, because these district council elections, they're symbolically a gigantic kind of sign of discontent by the people of Hong Kong. But these district councils, they control things like refuse collection and bus stops. They don't have much power. And it is entirely possible that the communist leaders in Beijing will look at this election result and say, OK, then we are never giving these people meaningful democracy, because look what they do when they have any ability to choose their leaders. And so it may be, tragically, that although in many ways we should cheer this kind of fantastically brave election result, it may be the last time they get to vote in that way.
David Rennie of The Economist, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Climate change is making sea levels rise. That's become very clear this fall in some areas along the East Coast, where high tide levels are breaking records. In many areas, there's been flooding during so-called king tides, times when, because of the moon's gravitational pull, tides are higher than usual. NPR's Greg Allen reports from the Florida Keys, where for months, king tides and sea level rise have left a community flooded.
To walk to Paul Butler's house, it's best to wear rubber boots.
Did you see the no-wake sign?
The no-wake signs are for drivers, not boaters. There are several inches of water on his street and others in this Key Largo neighborhood. Butler has lived here 25 years and has seen this kind of flooding before.
It used to happen like once a year during king tide, but it would only last for like a week or 10 days. And this year it's been going on for about 75 days, I think.
Neighbors say it's been 80 days and counting. The water doesn't drain because there's nowhere for it to go. During king tide, another neighbor, Brian Boylan, says seawater overtops the canal in his backyard.
This is actually the bay. It's even with the bay. You can see it coming right out of the ground. Sometimes you can see it bubbling.
Needless to say, Boylan and other neighbors aren't happy that they're now surrounded by water. The biggest problem?
Just driving through it. You know, you're ruining your vehicles. My truck's all rusty underneath.
Because it's salt water and corrosive.
Salt water, yeah. You know, we wash it off, but you can't get it. You know, the brakes will probably go.
Making things worse, the neighborhood was built on fill, and residents can point to areas where the ground has settled. But Boylan, who's lived here for 40 years, says it's clear another factor is rising sea level.
Obviously, see, it's going up, because I can tell from my dock. When I built the dock, it's probably up that 6 inches higher than it used to be.
Not far away on Virginia Key, scientists are also charting the rising sea level.
So there's actually two different kinds of tide gauges here.
One gauge in Miami belongs to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. It's just outside the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science, where Brian McNulty is a researcher. McNulty has been monitoring this gauge and comparing it with historical records. He says for 5 months running, the average here has broken past tide records.
Right now we're running about 8 to 9 inches above them, but There have been times in recent weeks we've been up to 18 inches, and that definitely is impactful.
Increased flooding from high tides is a problem not just in Florida, but also in other low-lying coastal communities around the U.S. Boston, Charleston, and Norfolk are just three cities that have seen flooding this year during exceptionally high king tides. William Sweet is an oceanographer with NOAA who released a report earlier this year warning of the increasing threat of high tide flooding. He says, unfortunately, the predictions are already coming true.
And now sea level rise, decades worth of it has caught up, and these sort of garden variety events, you know, seasonal high tides, winds blowing offshore that used to not be a problem, are a problem.
Although it's a global issue, for now it's local governments that are faced with the challenge of addressing high tide flooding. In Monroe County, home to the Florida Keys, local officials are hoping to get $150 million in federal funds, money that's supposed to help the area rebuild stronger after 2017's Hurricane Irma. They want to use it to raise roads and buildings and improve drainage. One of the projects would be in Paul Butler's long-flooded Key Largo neighborhood, but that will take years. In the meantime, he says, residents are making their own adjustments.
Well, it's kind of tough to go out and walk your dog unless you have hip boots on. There is people that are going to work that won't drive their vehicles through here. And they park up to the grocery store up on US 1, and they'll walk up.
Butler and other residents say if history is any guide, flooding should subside soon in their neighborhood, at least until the next king tide. Greg Allen, NPR News, Key Largo, Florida.
Every day, as many as 500 babies in sub-Saharan Africa are born with HIV. Now a study out of Botswana finds that if newborns are given treatment right away, the virus becomes almost undetectable. NPR's Ping Huang reports.
If a baby tests positive for HIV, standard practice in many sub-Saharan countries is to give them treatment, but not for weeks or even months after they're born. The concern is that newborns can't tolerate these powerful drugs. For some time, though, researchers have had a hunch that treating right at birth is better. Deborah Prasad is a virologist at Johns Hopkins, and she wrote a paper 6 years ago about a baby girl in Mississippi with HIV who was treated 30 hours after birth.
That baby was known to be infected, went off drugs, and then for 27 months, there was no signs of HIV.
But researchers weren't sure if this would work in other babies. A new clinical trial in Botswana gives an answer. 10 HIV-positive babies were given a three-drug cocktail within their first days. Writing in the journal Science Translational Medicine, the researchers report that 2 years out, these babies have very little virus in their bodies. Daniel Kuritskis, a study co-author and a doctor at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, says the kids aren't cured yet.
But it's likely that we may have set them up for the possibility of long-term remission of their HIV.
Kids that started drugs months after birth had 200 times more virus in their blood than those given treatment right away. Prasad at Johns Hopkins, who was not involved in the study, says it shows that giving drugs soon after birth keeps the virus from taking firm hold in the body.
Giving this very early treatment limited establishment of a long-lived reservoir.
Well, it's great to know that treating earlier is better. Kuritskis says one of the biggest hurdles will be getting drugs to babies that need them.
You really need the kind of infrastructure that exists in Botswana or in a country like the United States in order to be able to identify and rapidly intervene in these children.
About half the babies in sub-Saharan Africa infected with HIV don't have access to antiretroviral drugs. Researchers say that needs to change. Ping Huang, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:19, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Smoke billowed for hours from a Texas chemical plant after an early morning blast yesterday, and then another large explosion ripped through the plant in the early afternoon, sending up a huge ball of fire. NPR's Rachel Martin talks to Matt Dempsey of the Houston Chronicle about regulatory failures of the chemical industry in the wake of the explosions, coming up in just about 15 minutes.
There was a time when high-speed rail almost came to Wisconsin. Some people loved the idea.
So there were all these ideas, wants and desires and needs in the community that seemed to get tied together in this neat package.
But the project had its critics.
It was a bright, shiny object, but ultimately failed the test of common sense.
Derailed is a new podcast from WPR, where we explore what this train says about our increasingly divided state.
It's available now wherever you get your podcasts and at WPR.org.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Security Health Plan, dedicated to providing neighborly customer service, and health plans for large and small Wisconsin employers. Full details about health plans are at securityhealth.org.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Funeral Home. Every detail counts and every memory matters. Allow the compassionate, caring staff at Piasecki to take care of all your funeral needs, serving the community since 1931.
In WPR weather, a winter storm watch goes into effect tomorrow evening for northern Wisconsin. Today, cloudy skies. The north might get some afternoon snow showers, and some wintry mix is a possibility tonight around the state. Highs in the low to mid-30s. On Friday, rain, snow, and freezing drizzle are possible. The storm watch kicks in Friday night with 5 to 10 inches of snow possible in the north and highs in the mid-30s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, offering a variety of credit card options with features for a range of customers, from foodies to travelers. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Credit approval required. Capital One Bank, USA, NA. From Viking, committed to providing carefully curated and culturally enriching journeys, sailing Europe's Danube and Rhine rivers. Learn more at vikingcruises.com. And from Focus Features and Participant with Dark Waters, a thriller starring Mark Ruffalo and Anne Hathaway. Mysterious deaths in a small town lead one man to risk his life for the truth. Now playing in select theaters everywhere December 6th.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin, wishing you and yours a very happy and peaceful Thanksgiving. And I say peaceful because we all know holidays in general can be tense. You gather with family that you may not have seen in forever. You may not really have anything in common with them outside your DNA. And then you add in different political ideologies and things can get stressful. Layer on top of that, the possible impeachment of the president. And well, you've got yourself a Thanksgiving for the ages, and not necessarily in a good way. You know who's really smart about this stuff? Celeste Headlee, veteran public radio journalist and the author of the book We Need to Talk. And we are so lucky that Celeste is in our studios. Hi.
Hi. It's great to see you.
So nice to see you. So you talk about how people's anxiety about just the mere possibility of having intense exchanges with friends or family around the holidays is not based in reality. What does that mean?
Well, it means that, you know, they do a YouGov HuffPost poll survey on this topic, and it turns out that the number of people who say it's quite likely they'll get into an argument is 4%.
Huh.
Yeah. It's a very small amount. And sadly, the reason for part of this is because we are so ideologically separated. People tend to marry people who agree with them. People tend to hang out with people who agree with them. So that means that less than 25% of Americans are going to sit down at the table with someone who doesn't agree with them on politics. But it also means that for the vast majority of Americans, again, 96%, not likely to get into an argument.
Because we're self-selecting. But
we're self-selecting, but also we're basically polite, you know?
Right. Yeah. Which you say isn't necessarily a good thing. I mean, you want people to talk about complicated subjects, and you say we shouldn't be afraid to discuss politics.
Yeah. You know, instead of avoiding topics like politics and religion because you're afraid of a fight, I would rather people learn how to talk about those things without fighting. Because what ends up happening when you avoid these subjects is it just makes you particularly ignorant about those particular subjects. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I would very much rather people simply learn to talk about these subjects together and allow other people to hold a different opinion, realizing that there's no stakes. Right? No policy is going to change because of your argument about politics.
But could a relationship change?
Yes, absolutely. the issue isn't what relationship changes after the conversation. What I really have a problem with is when people go into a conversation or choose not to on principle. Right? I'm not going to talk to this person because their opinion is so outside the pale.
Right.
That's the problem. Because what you have to understand is most arguments are caused by trying to change someone else's mind. So let me just free you of that forever. You will not change their mind.
So then the purpose, if not to change someone's mind, is to understand.
Right.
It's empathy.
Exactly.
And you're right. It's not, if you come armed with stats and reports, like you know this particular uncle is going to show up at Thanksgiving and you know he feels this way about this issue and you print out all the news articles, that's just not going to work.
No, I mean, that means you're coming prepared to talk, right? You're not coming prepared to listen. I mean, if you want to say, hey, it's going to be tough for me to listen to what my uncle says, I mean, think about what I need to do when I start feeling angry and want to yell at him. Let me prepare for that. But bringing in all your statistics is probably a waste of time.
What if someone stirs up trouble?
So I try not to ignore that it happened. Let me give you an example from my personal life. When I was very first meeting my fiance's family, I'm mixed race, and his dad told an extraordinarily racist joke. And he looked at my fiance, looked at me like, oh, God. And I turned to him and I said, you know what? I'm part black. That was a really racist joke. So let's, between you and I, let's find some more jokes that you could tell, because I don't want you to ever tell that one again.
Huh.
And of course, he was like, oh, no, I'm not racist. I was like, well, that was a really racist joke. I mean, there's just no way around that. But I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt.
Right.
And let's move on.
Right.
And let's talk about something else you can do. I'm
and
not
you also
saying...
tried to diffuse it with humor a little
exactly.
bit, too.
Exactly. Right? Which people say all the time. And I understand those who say,
it's not funny.
Right. It's not funny. Right. And yet you have to ask what your goal is. Right? What is your goal in calling out that person? Is it to feel better about you and to get that feeling of sort of release of yelling at somebody? Or is it to actually maybe build a bridge where there isn't one, a bridge of understanding?
Okay, so we've talked about politics and religion and race and identity. Those are big issues that immediately get provocative quick. What if it's just an uncomfortable question that someone asks you? You know, like, hey, you know, when are you guys going to have a kid? When am I getting a grandbaby? Or, hey, you seem to have dropped a ton of weight. Why are you eating so much on Thanksgiving?
Yeah, so here's what I often say to those things when people ask me inappropriate questions, is I turn around and say, wow, that's a really personal question. Why do you ask? Or if somebody says, are you still on that diet? And I'll say, it's going fine. How's your eating?
Your eating? Because it's said, when you put it that way, it's like, wait, what? Why
exactly.
Is this person even inquiring?
I think sometimes people just say stuff and they may, again, I try to give them the benefit of the doubt and assume they don't realize how inappropriate it is.
Yeah.
But in classic journalist fashion, if you turn the question back on them, it may make them go, oh, I don't like answering that question. And it may actually get them to stop asking that question again. But that's usually what I'll say, is some version of, why do you ask?
Yeah.
If you have to, you can say, wow, do you like to be asked about your diet? I sure don't. But I would say don't ignore it.
But that's what I love about all of this advice. Just don't ignore it. Just kind of acknowledge things and be respectful. Come from a place of love. Call things out when you need to and have
a meal. Anyone who has a loved one of whatever permutation of loved one it is knows you don't agree on everything. It may be something like how you load the dishwasher, right? Which it turns out is a huge bone of contention in a lot of partnerships. So, of course, these people that you see once a year or twice a year, you're not going to agree on a lot of stuff. It's okay. It's not the end of the world.
Celeste Headlee, she is the author of We Need to Talk. Thank you so much, my friend.
My pleasure, my friend.
This is NPR News.
50 years ago, a group of Native American activists laid claim to Alcatraz Island.
We will purchase said Alcatraz Island for $24 in glass beads and red cloth.
a precedent set by the white man's purchase of a similar island about 300 years ago.
The protests lasted for 19 months. This Thanksgiving, hundreds will gather on the island to honor the anniversary. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, NPR News and Classical Music.
It's Morning Edition on WPR, and the latest news from NPR is up next. In Wisconsin news today, an anonymous donation to a northeastern Wisconsin school district will be used to pay off the district's lunch debt. Details of that story and all the day's news for you coming up.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. The Washington Post reports President Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, had been in negotiations with Ukraine's top prosecutor earlier this year to line up work for his firm. At the same time, Giuliani sought Ukraine's help to investigate former Vice President Biden and his son. The Post says Giuliani was negotiating to have his company represent the prosecutor as the prosecutor sought to recover money believed stolen from Ukraine's government. Post reporter Matt Zapatosky spoke to NPR's Morning Edition.
At the same time that Rudy Giuliani is pressing this Ukrainian prosecutor, a guy named Yuri Lutsenko, to help him investigate the Bidens, he's trying to cut kind of a side deal where Yuri Lutsenko will pay him $200,000 or $300,000 as a retainer fee to help Yuri Lutsenko with this kind of asset recovery mission.
On social media, Giuliani says he did not pursue a business opportunity in Ukraine and that no deal was ever done. It's unclear whether former White House counsel Don McGahn will be forced to testify to House lawmakers. Last night, a federal appeals court issued a stay of a lower court's ruling that ordered McGahn to comply with a congressional subpoena and appear on Capitol Hill. The appeals court will consider a longer stay at a hearing in January. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Melissa Ingalls. A U.S.-Canadian agency that oversees Great Lakes water levels says it will continue to give a board flexibility with managing levels and flows on Lake Ontario. Officials are hoping to release more water to reduce the risk of flooding there. Elected officials and residents have been pushing for higher flows to release more water from Lake Ontario as it's seen record-breaking levels this year. The International Lake Ontario St. Lawrence River Board has been able to do that. Now the International Joint Commission says the board may continue to do so even as water levels drop. The shipping industry fears increasing flows would make navigation unsafe and effectively shut down the remainder of the season. The Chamber of Marine Commerce says that could cost the U.S. and Canadian economies $193 million a week. A member of the board says for now they plan to keep flows at the same level, slightly above the safe navigation limit until the shipping season ends. Milwaukee will become the eighth city in the country to create an office for Veterans Affairs. The Common Council created the office this week to coordinate the needs of the city's veterans and their families. The office is being modeled after one in San Antonio. Pam Fent heads the Milwaukee Area Labor Council. She says veterans face unique challenges when they return from active duty.
Great to think about another resource for connecting them to opportunity so that they can have a good reentry into civilian life.
According to the National Center for Veterans, there are about 42,000 veterans living in Milwaukee County and 345,000 living in Wisconsin. The city hopes to open the veterans' office by spring. The head of the Air Force will not stop efforts to discharge a Wisconsin Air National Guard whistleblower. Master Sergeant Jay Ellis complained to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin last year about sexual assaults and harassment within his 115th Fighter Wing Squadron. His complaints triggered two federal investigations. Ellis alleges his superiors are trying to discharge him on trumped-up medical issues and deny him retirement benefits in retaliation. Baldwin asked U.S. Air Force Secretary Barbara Barrett last week to put the discharge process on hold until an investigation into Ellis's retaliation allegations ends. Baldwin's spokesman John Krause said Wednesday that the secretary responded by saying she will not halt the process but will not approve any discharge recommendation until the retaliation investigation is complete. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from TIAA, committed to the idea that while most things in life run out, From clean shirts in the morning to a favorite dessert at night, lifetime income in retirement shouldn't. Learn more at TIAA.org/neverrunout. And from FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at FJC.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. It feels like a familiar story. Explosions at a chemical plant in Texas. On Wednesday, two huge blasts sent plumes of dark smoke above the city of Port Neches. Three workers were injured and thousands of residents have been evacuated. The disaster comes days after the Trump administration reversed a series of chemical safety regulations. Matt Dempsey is a data editor on the Houston Chronicle's investigative team. He's reported on the regulatory failures of the chemical industry, and he joins us now. Matt, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly were these regulations that the Trump administration has now reversed?
Yeah, as my reporting partner Perla Treviso and I wrote last week, the new rules would make it so that companies are no longer required to do third-party audits or root cause analysis after an incident. They will also not have to provide the public access to information about what type of chemicals are stored in these facilities either.
So just to be clear, that's the situation now that the Trump administration has reversed Obama-era rules?
Yes.
Okay, got it.
This is after the reversal.
Okay. We should note the safety regulations, as I noted, they were introduced under President Obama in response to a 2013 explosion at a fertilizer company in Texas. 15 people died in that. I mean, what difference did those regulations make when you think about that disaster?
Right. I mean, to start, the Obama-era regulations never actually went into effect. They were designed to be implemented over a series of time, but they were rolled back before they could be fully implemented. And on top of that, those regulations were fairly industry-friendly. It mirrored industry group standards. It required more reporting and analysis, required companies to consider safer technology, but it didn't require them to do those things, like to change the tech they were using. There just wasn't a lot of teeth in the rolled back regulations.
So in your reporting, you say the story of chemical incidents in the United States is a history of, quote, near misses. Explain what that means.
Right. So in the last few decades, the U.S. just hasn't seen the worst of what a chemical incident could be. So even in incidents where people have died or properties have been destroyed, we've been fortunate that those cases weren't worse. And like, for example, this week's explosion, if it had happened when school was in session last week, or if it happened at 1 in the afternoon instead of 1 in the morning, we'd be a completely different scenario when it comes to fatalities and injuries.
So what's the bottom line here, Matt? I mean, if the previous rules were too lax, didn't really make a difference and weren't even really implemented, and now the Trump administration has rolled those back, I mean, how safe are chemical plants in Texas right now?
Right. I mean, the companies are very tightly regulated, but they're not really policed very much. So the EPA and OSHA don't come in very often. So we have to rely on companies doing the right thing 100% of the time. And like airline crashes, these are low frequency but high consequence events. But unlike airline crashes, this could kill thousands or hundreds if something goes really wrong. So it's really important for facilities to be operated properly and for government regulators to be on site and do something when something goes wrong or before something goes wrong.
It's really interesting, too, because you say the onus is really on these chemical plants to police themselves. And that was the situation with Boeing after these two deadly crashes. It came to light that Boeing, too much of the responsibility for its own safety checks resided with the company itself.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good example or analogy, because one of the things people talk about a lot here is, well, first responders aren't getting all the information they need about hazards before they come in. Well, even if they had perfect information about what was at a facility, they have to lean on the individual facility to tell them what's actually happening. We still don't know the next day what's happened at the TPC explosion, for example.
All right, Matt Dempsey, reporter at the Houston Chronicle. Matt, we appreciate you sharing your reporting on this. Thank you so much and happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to y'all, too.
Thanksgiving is the traditional start of the ski season in the United States. There's usually enough snow around for resorts to open by now. But ski areas need something else. Seasonal workers, who are becoming harder to find. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports.
David Bird with the National Ski Areas Association says
For a long time, ski resorts had one big incentive to attract all the workers they needed, a season pass.
Those days are long gone.
That's true, says Lauren Duke with Steamboat Springs Ski Resort in Colorado. She says it's tough to hire with unemployment around 4% nationally.
The resort industry usually trends with the economy.
Here at the base of the Steamboat's Christie Peak Express Lift, Duke says that means resorts have to do more.
I think everyone in the ski industry is always looking for ways to make their workplace the best workplace.
Steamboat has increased base wages to $12.50 an hour, about $1.50 above Colorado's minimum wage. Seasonal workers who stay on for 9 to 11 months get benefits like health insurance and paid time off and parental leave. Those only on for the ski season get perks like warm lunch or dinner for $3 to $5 and discounted lift tickets for friends and family. Plus, their season pass can be used at other resorts in the area. Deb Holloway, a 26-season veteran of Steamboat Ski Patrol, says she's seen affordable housing become more of an issue.
The amount of reasonable rental properties, I think, is certainly diminishing over time, and that's tough.
As second homes and services like Airbnb and VRBO are reducing housing stock in resort areas, more resorts are offering workforce housing. Steamboat offers some staff rentals for $350 to $450 a month, about two-thirds cheaper than the lowest-end local free market rentals. Plus, Steamboat's units are right next to the resort. Norman Nickerson says that kind of proximity is important.
You're not going to drive from Denver all the way to Vail every single day as a worker.
Nickerson directs the University of Montana's Institute for Tourism and Recreation Research.
I know that some of the ski resorts have said, well, if we don't get full staff, we're right on that edge, and then, of course, somebody gets sick or they can't be there for a few days. The administrative people are out there doing those jobs just to fill in.
And when that doesn't cut it, she says resorts cut down on services, like reducing restaurant hours and closing particular runs.
You're leaving money on the table. They don't want to do that, but they're forced to.
Another wrinkle in the industry's labor market, resorts have traditionally depended on foreign workers in the U.S. on J-1 visas. But a Trump administration executive order placing restrictions on that program means that pool of employees has also been reduced. David Byrd says it's not just a problem across the Rockies.
What I hear a lot from ski area owners and operators, and it's true from large resorts down to small resorts, we're not filling close to all the jobs that we have that are available.
And if you do land one of those jobs, you'll still get the season pass. But ski resorts now know that alone just isn't a sweet enough deal anymore. For NPR News, I'm Maggie Mullen in Laramie.
That story came to us from the Mountain West News Bureau. This is NPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's 8:42 right now. In 9 minutes, NPR's Rachel Martin and resident poet Kwame Alexander are back to read our crowdsourced community sports poem. And in that spirit, I've been working on a sports haiku this morning, inspired by my past life as a Michigan native. Here it is. Tradition is hard. Thanksgiving Day, it's so close. Detroit Lions lose. It's Morning Edition.
Wisconsin Public Radio Travel is teaming up with UW-Stevens Point Adventure Tours for an exploration of Germany's castles by bike and boat. I'm Mary-Kate McCoy, and I'll be alongside experienced cycle tour leaders Amy Bulk and Bill Fehrenbach for this 11-day journey next June. We'll take in the sights, sounds, and taste of the Rhine's Castle Valley by bike, and in the evening, we return aboard the MS Olympia. We'll see Germany's castles by bike and boat. Details are available at wpr.org/travel.
Support for WPR comes from small businesses across the state. Saturday, November 30th is Small Business Saturday, a shopping holiday to support local business. WPR is proud of our sponsors. A full list is at wpr.org/sponsor.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring piccolo bread, baked fresh every Saturday morning at the Masonic Center, where the market is held from 10 until 2. Proceeds benefit the lodge. Piccolo bread is perfect for sandwiches, toast, snacking, and more.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and here are some of the major stories of the day. China says the implementation of U.S. bills on Hong Kong human rights will undermine cooperation in important areas. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Geng Shuang made the remarks in response to a question about whether President Donald Trump's signing of the legislation will impact ongoing trade talks. Fired Navy Secretary Richard Spencer has written an opinion article sharply critical of President Trump for intervening in the war crimes case of a Navy SEAL. Spencer wrote in the Washington Post on Wednesday that Trump's action was, quote, shocking and unprecedented. He also said that the commander-in-chief, quote, has very little understanding of how the American military works. And Wisconsin farmers will receive a smaller portion of dollars spent on Thanksgiving dinner than during the rest of the year. That's according to a report from the National Farmers Union. Stay tuned. We'll have all the latest news from NPR and WPR coming up in 15 minutes.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hanes, donating 250,000 pairs of socks to homeless shelters in all 50 states and more than 3 million pairs since 2009. Information on how to help the homeless is at Hanes.com/sockdrive. And from Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, developing ways to use the PD-L1 pathway in immunotherapy to treat cancer. Committed to making contributions in cancer treatment for 72 years. Danafarber.org/everywhere.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Campuses around the country are struggling to balance free speech with incidents of bigotry and hate speech. This month at Indiana University Bloomington, the provost condemned tweets from a tenured professor named Eric Rasmussen. The provost described the tweets as racist, sexist, and homophobic, but she said the school could not fire him. Meanwhile, Syracuse University in upstate New York is dealing with a run of anti-Semitic, Islamophobic, and racist incidents on their campus. NPR's Anya Kamenetz has been following these situations and joins us now. Hi, Anya.
Hi, Rachel.
So let's start with Syracuse. What's the backstory there?
So at Syracuse, the FBI and local law enforcement are investigating a dozen different incidents, including racist graffiti, threats, and slurs being yelled at some students, at least in some cases by fellow students. And in response, anti-racist protesters held a sit-in lasting several days. And one Syracuse professor I talked to called the campus a powder keg.
Well, and Indiana University?
So at Indiana, an economics professor, Eric Rasmussen, he shared an article from a right-wing website on Twitter with a headline about women destroying academia. And some of his previous public statements were unearthed and found to be racist, sexist, and homophobic.
And this is where we introduce the provost of that school, right? Lauren Robel, she condemned this.
Right. She issued a kind of unusual statement in which she said that no one would be forced to take classes with this professor, but that the university wasn't going to fire him because as a public university, they're bound by the First Amendment. And Rasmussen has responded online, we should say. He said that he's been mischaracterized and he called the whole thing a kerfuffle.
So, Anya, there isn't any explicit connection between these two situations,
No. At
least on the surface. Okay. So what do they have in common?
Well, they're both examples, Rachel, of an increasingly common trend where racism and bigotry are rearing their head on college campuses, and colleges are struggling to respond because colleges have this institutional commitment to freedom of speech and actually a diversity of thought and ideology and debate. And so some experts are saying that Rasmussen's case is probably best understood as a question of academic freedom and not only the First Amendment, meaning on campuses, there's sort of a super First Amendment. The core of what it means to be a scholar is to be able to research and debate unpopular ideas and not be silenced.
And what about Syracuse?
So these same values, Rachel, are in tension also at Syracuse. You know, there's a history here. The hashtag of the activists that they're using is not again SU, because there was an incident about a year and a half ago where fraternity members were suspended for creating racist videos. And since then, the campus has been reviewing its policies on free speech and civil discourse and also trying to increase diversity and inclusion. But, you know, there's a bigger picture here as well. The FBI reports that hate crimes are on the rise on campuses nationwide since 2015. In fact, just in the last few weeks, there's been incidents involving swastikas and nooses and other messages at the University of Georgia, at Auburn, at Iowa State, and the University of Wisconsin.
Wow.
Yeah. So what the activists at Syracuse are saying is that this is part of a pattern, and they don't want this to be swept under the rug. And the university leadership is accepting many of the activists' demands, but there's still a lot of dissatisfaction. This is Jen Jackson. She's an assistant professor of political science at Syracuse.
The primary purpose of university is to teach students and to prepare them for the world. If it is a place where they can't even walk on campus and feel safe, then the university is not meeting its primary goal and function and objective.
She told me her students of color, LGBT, immigrant, or Jewish students, they're scared, and that's not conducive to learning or free debate.
NPR's Anya Kamenetz, thank you so much for your reporting on this, Anya. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Rachel.
This is NPR News.
10 minutes before 9 now, Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up, classical music with Stephanie Elkins for your Thanksgiving. She'll start with A Prayer of Thanksgiving, played by the Boston Pops Orchestra. Also, Cafe Music by Paul Schoenfield and The Harvest Home Suite by Jay Unger. All that and much more to be heard this Thanksgiving Day on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, that's what keeps you coming back. Visit jackandrea.com for more information.
Despair transformed into gratitude. WPR is pleased to support community engagement in the arts. Find out more at wpr.org/events.
In sports, the Bucks beat the Atlanta Hawks last night 111-102. Milwaukee continues to sit atop the Eastern Conference. The Marquette men's basketball team hosts Davidson Wildcats this afternoon at 4 o'clock. And here's what the weather looks like. A winter storm watch goes into effect tomorrow evening for northern Wisconsin. Today, cloudy skies. The north might get some snow showers and some wintry mix as a possibility tonight around the state. Highs in the low to mid-30s. On Friday, rain, snow, and freezing drizzle are possible. The storm watch kicks in Friday night with 5 to 10 inches of snow possible in the north. Highs in the mid-30s. Looking ahead to Saturday, rain in the south, a mix of rain and snow in central Wisconsin, and snow in the north, highs from the upper 30s to upper 40s.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Rachel Martin, here with our poet in residence, Kwame Alexander. Hello, Kwame.
Hey there, Rachel. How you doing?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing?
I'm super.
You're super. You're always super.
What can I say? I'm batting 1,000. I'm undefeated.
Nice.
Like, just call me Ace.
Ace, when we were last together, we shared some sports poetry and we asked our listeners to send in their masterpieces. And they did, right?
How many did we get?
Over 500.
Wow.
I know. It's pretty good.
I know I say this a lot, but this poetry thing really works.
It does.
I think people love it because it lets them feel more connected to others.
Yeah.
I found an interesting quote about poetry from a Polish poet whose name I can never pronounce correctly. Czesław Miłosz. The purpose of poetry is to remind us how difficult it is to remain just one person. For our house is open. There are no keys in the doors. An invisible guest come in and out at will.
So true, right? Okay, with that, shall we present our Morning Edition community poem about sports?
Game on, Rachel Martin. You start and I'll sub.
Okay, here we go. The trail has been treacherous, rocky and twisting. I'm tempted to quit, my poor legs resisting, but up this steep hill I continue to rally. Envisioning flowers that bloom in the valley.
I'm a hurricane force with the blue jacket sting. I flash to the finish like my feet have wings. You think you got skill with your high jump technique? I spring through the air while you're tripping on your feet. I hurtle through the world while you stub your toes.
I'm the queen of the fast lane, everybody knows. So bring your best, your talent, your speed. The ladies from Daniels don't follow, we lead.
The girl's got hoops and she's 5'9", a skinny brown bean pole. I'm so proud she's mine. I had pushed for ballet slippers. She quietly agreed. Graceful but loveless, she did it for me. Now on that court with the ball in her hand, more graceful than ever, the dance finally began. Crisp movements, catching the eyes of everyone in the room, gliding across the floor as if on water, jumping with the beat of the melody.
There's something about the arc the ball makes as it traces the path between us. Catch and throw, the warmth of the early spring sun, the slap of the ball into leather, the movement of muscles, automatic, familiar. We ease into it, loosening our arms with throws casual and slow.
We have played this game with Nerf balls, babies sleeping in the other room, with tennis balls and swimming pools, showing off our acrobatic diving catches. A 10 from the American judge on grassy fields with bases, giggling kids racing between, caught in a pickle.
Through 40 years of friendship and 30 of marriage, this has been a constant. Shall I compare thee to a stand-up double? Thou art more welcome and more absolute.
Hey, honey, got your glove?
Now we take it more seriously than when we were any good. Before the joint surgeries, when we could still hit without pain, when we had legs. Now we play not to lose. But today, everyone that shows up wins. This sun, this sky, these companionable partners, these comprehensible lines.
When you have ice blocks for feet, icicle fingers, and a lump in your throat to tremble your body with cold tomorrow, you doubt the sanity of waking at 5, the 8-year-old on ice by 6, blades carving shapes you can't name. And when your boy looks through his coach's face on the bench, red cheeks, a fire in each wooded eye, complains about tripping, that number 16 with the black mask says, I'll chop him down next time, you doubt this game. At the hour you venture into the warm room to thaw out your spine and hear a father break down his son's backhand highlight spinner in a voice loud enough for all to hear, you know the annual backyard ice sheet was a bad idea.
This is not what forgiveness is supposed to look like. Fast food tacos and football. The game should be a reason to talk, but as players flatten each other, we watch with flat faces. Football steals Sundays. Hun, weekends are for family. Help with these damn kids.
Stop. Imagine the universe, green sun to planet or whatever, where this is poetry. Where Monday morning papers put a poet, mouth open, arm rising, on the front page, and in its own section, there are statistical landscapes ranking metaphors and similes, top 10 rundown of the season's best opening and closing lines, investigative articles on the billions of hours of lost office productivity due to online fantasy poet leagues.
There's a big burly man in a headset somewhere, weeping and waving his hands about Kwame Alexander before 4 sportscasters in matching tweed blazers slap each other on the back and stage an analytical replay of an Emily Dickinson stanza with unseen markers drawing arrows and lines across the screen.
The sky was clear. The snow was deep. I prayed the Lord my soul to keep, then launched myself down mountain steep in search of alpine glory.
I skied the bumps with grace and flair. I hit the jumps and caught some air. I didn't know that rock was there. And that concludes my story.
Man, our listeners are ballers. That was an awesome cornucopia, a poet pourri, if you will.
A poet pourri.
A poet pourri of the wild world of sports.
We had tennis and baseball, track, cross country, of course, football.
We had some ballet in there and basketball and hockey.
Yep. Thanks to all of you, all of our listeners who submitted poems. We so appreciate it.
We can't share all of them, but there's so many wonderful contributions. It's such an honor to read and to help create this community crowdsourced poem.
We love it every time we do this. Kwame Alexander is a regular contributor to Morning Edition, a huge Mystics fan, we should say, and the inaugural innovator in residence at the American School in London. Kwame, happy Thanksgiving.
You as well, Rachel. Cheers.
Yes, it's Thanksgiving, but Black Friday is almost upon us, and we want to hear from you. Do you have any privacy questions about high-tech gadgets you might be shopping for this holiday season? Or have you ever experienced a creepy moment because of intelligent technology you currently use? If so, we want to hear your stories. You can tweet us at Morning Edition with your questions and comments, and then we'll ask a tech industry watcher for their advice. This is Morning Edition from NPR News on this Thanksgiving Day. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
You can hear Morning Edition weekdays from 5 to 9 here on WPR. To follow developments throughout the day, visit WPR.org. There you can check out statewide reports from WPR's award-winning news team, plus national and global headlines from NPR. Stay with us. News from NPR and WPR is next, and then music with Stephanie Elkins.
Support for WPR comes from Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Foster parents make a positive difference in the life of a child and in their community. More info about becoming a foster parent is at chw.org/TFC.
Support comes from Sweet Impact Chocolates, an eco-friendly producer of handmade truffles and caramels, where 10% of sales are donated to organizations helping disadvantaged women and children. Shop locally or online. SweetImpactChocolates.com.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.